Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's it like to live, work, and play at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? The White House is an enduring source of fascination in the United States and abroad, both for the remarkable things that have happened there over 200 years of history and for the ways each of its occupants have sought to make the place their own. William Bouchong is historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association. He's also a contributor to the new National Geographic book, Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think the most remarkable thing about the White House is that it serves so many functions. It's an office complex. It's a historic site. It's a media center. It's an official entertainment venue. But as is pointed out in the book, it is first and foremost a home. Can you talk about what it takes to allow for all of that to exist in the same location?
Well, all of those functions, of course, have evolved over time. At the beginning, when John Adams moved in, it was a residence and really a makeshift office for the most part. He only had one or two people to help him. As time passed, the president's staff grew, and with that, they actually lived in the house. Some of them actually lived with the president, mm-hmm. like Lincoln's secretaries, Hay and Nicolay. The east side of the second floor of the house was taken over basically by an office until 1902, when Theodore Roosevelt was able to convince Congress to provide the funds to build a small little annex on the west side, which would grow and become what we know today as the West Wing, really the heart of the presidential executive branch, and on that side of the building. So, as you can see, what was happening is over time these different functions were being added to the house. And then in the 1960s, when Mrs. Kennedy began a program of what she called a restoration of the White House, she was the one who spearheaded the movement to actually turn the house into a museum as well as a residence, an office, a stage for the great diplomatic events that occur there and that sort of thing. So it's an interesting thing. The house has evolved with the country just over these 200 plus years.
George Washington is, of course, the only U.S. president never to have spent even a single night in the White House, but he did select its exact location. What kind of setting was the location of the White House at the time it was built?
Well, we often hear that Washington was a swamp, and that's sort of, I think, a bit of a knock on George Washington, if you think about it, because let's face it, he was a surveyor. He ought to know where to place a prominent structure like the White House. The area around that in the Potomac, along the Potomac River, there was a very beautiful wetlands, really, and it was not a swamp. It took many years of agricultural development upstream to eventually clog up those systems that in terms of the ecosystem and the estuaries, and eventually Washington did become a swamp by the 1840s or so in terms of the heat and the miasmic quality of the character of the area. But nonetheless, it was a beautiful bucolic scene, and if you see some of the early 19th century artists who depicted the White House, you can see that very, very, very clearly displayed in their artwork. So, when Mrs. Adams moved into the house, she marveled at how beautiful the view was down the river toward Mount Vernon from the house. And it was really a breathtaking view until, of course, the advent of railroad and highways, which have marred that a little bit in terms of that long, beautiful vista. But even today, you have a wonderful view from the house out to the Jefferson Memorial. That's probably one of the most breathtaking sights you can see for when you stand in the Blue Room.
So the Adams family moved in. They were the first family to live there. And then Abigail Adams was faced with a problem, that she lived in this grand place. She wanted to represent the fledgling United States. So what was she to do with the family's unmentionables after they had been washed?
The President's Wash was hung up in the East Room, which was unfinished at that time and would not be finished until Andrew Jackson's first administration. So it was really just a bare brick-walled area where she could hang the family's private laundry without the world seeing them. In fact, the presidents hung their laundry, or their staff did, in the basement area right through the most of the 19th century. And then some very rare, interesting images popped up with some research we were doing on the resident staff a few years back, where we found a photograph of the president's wash actually hung outside behind what was the first West Wing building. So that's really kind of an interesting photograph, in that they did eventually try to get them and out into the sunlight too. But nonetheless, the president's laundry had to be under wraps, I guess.
So the White House is designed in the Irish Georgian style. What does that mean exactly?
Well, the architect is the Irish-born architect James Hoban. And Hoban had trained in Ireland as an apprentice, and of course was familiar with the great buildings of Dublin, as well as the countryside in Ireland. And model that's often cited for the White House's design is Leinster House, which is a great Georgian house that was built in Dublin that today serves as the home of their legislature in the capital. So the idea is that then it's essentially you're talking about a period in architecture known as the Georgian period, which is really hallmarked by symmetry and the sort of order and rational order that you want to put on the face you want to show to the world. It's very owed its lineage, I guess, to the sort of the Palladian architecture that is also very similar in terms of the emphasis on symmetry and balance.
Why did we never refer to the White House as a presidential palace? It certainly is a grand building, and yet it has a pretty humble name.
Well, the original designer of the city of Washington, who initially was to design the White House and the Capitol, but ran into problems working with the president's commissioners and eventually was dismissed, Pierre Charles L'Enfant, actually wanted to call in fact, on his maps, his early maps of the city, he does, in fact, show it as the president's palace. And he shows the grounds around it, an 80-acre area. And that would be really the type of thing that you'd expect to find for a European monarch rather than, a more Republican president in the United States. So it was something that was proposed, certainly, but George Washington just didn't like that terminology at all, and he was the one who wanted it to be named the President's House, which he did. And that's why the house was known as the President's House officially until about 1902, when 1901 is when T.R. came into office, and then he changed the name to the White House. And what he did really is just, officially give the house a name that it had been known locally as the White House for many, many years. In fact, there's some correspondence that goes back as early as 1808 where congressmen are writing about going to visit the White House, not the president's house. So it's been a name that's been around locally for a long, long time, and Roosevelt really just created it and made it official. And there was a time in the mid-19th century, too, when presidents put the executive mansion on the stationery to sort of, I guess, gussy up the idea of where you would be going. But the house is really, as you say, it's always been a huge landmark in the city. It was the first public building, and it loomed over what was really just a struggling little village when it was first built.
So many people are aware that the original White House was burned in the War of 1812, although it was in fact destroyed in 1814, but the war started in 1812. Was anything salvaged, Bill, from the original structure?
Not very much, unfortunately. Of course, the famous thing that was saved, or some, of course, documents and state documents and other things that Dolly Madison had saved, as well as the famous story of her having saved the portrait of George Washington, which was bought as the first government purchase for the White House, and to hang in the house. And she, of course, saves the portrait of Washington, and that is really the only art object that is left from the original White House that's in the house today. And then a few other things have come back into the collection from a number of the Marauders, who basically were, the British and the Canadians who were as part of that party that burned the house, took a few items with them, and those passed down in the families. And one of those was a medicine chest that came back to the White House that had been owned by the Madisons that now is back into the collection. And a few other remnants, like a hat box that Dolly Madison gave to Benjamin Henry Latrobe's wife, Mary Latrobe, who was a very good friend of Dolly Madison's. And the interior of that hat box had the original wallpaper that was in the house, because Benjamin Henry Latrobe had worked with Dolly Madison to redesign the salons of the main parlors of the first floor of the White House during her time as First Lady, and so that was kind of a memento of that. So those are the few bits and pieces of history that we have that survived the fire.
What kind of ghost stories have been told in and around the White House over the years?
Lots of them, of course. I mean, any old house, and especially a big one like the White House, is going to have its ghost stories, and the things that go bump in the night and the squeaks and creaks and things that you hear in old structures. Most of those stories really emanate in the 19th century, when newspapermen had a slow news day. And I can give you a good example of that is there was in the late 19th century, there was a worker at the White House. His name was Jerry Smith, and he had been a part of the staff since the time of U.S. Grant. He came in as a stable boy and worked around the house, and then worked his way up sort of through the ranks. And by the time that he retired in the early 20th century, he was sort of like the president's kept the Oval Office clean and dusted, and did minor things like that as when he was quite old. Obviously, he'd been in service for over 50 years. So anyway, the reporters who would be, just hanging around, talking to staff and doing things, and, they would press Jerry Smith, because he was the longest lived and had been around the house the longest, about if he knew anything of any ghosts in the house. And, of course, this sort of led to stories, and eventually Jerry would spin the famous story of the Lincoln ghost being that he had seen Lincoln in the house from time to time. And then he also said McKinley was another one of the ghosts that was around, and that he would know that they were coming because he would hear a buzz. Now, whether, what all that means, I don't know. But the most interesting ghost story, though, I think, and one that really does have some real substance to it, was written in a letter from Archibald Butt, who was the president's chief aide, both Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. And he wrote his sister Clara an interesting letter, and he was telling her that he was being called in by the staff, the resident staff of the White House, to investigate a ghost that they called the Thing, which to what they were saying was a 15-year-old youth who would touch them on their shoulder as they were walking through the private quarters on the second floor of the house at night, and just scared the willies out of them. And so they were wanted this investigated to figure out what was going on. Well, but we don't really know what happened with the full investigation of this, because apparently William Howard Taft, the president at the time, shut the whole thing down, and he said that if anybody said one peep about this, they would be fired summarily. So that was sort of squashed that story in its right there. But the funny thing is that
let me jump in. Hold that punchline for just a second. My guest is William Bouchong, historian and webmaster for the White House Historical Association, contributor to the new book Inside the White House. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU, with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with William Bouchong, historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association and contributor to the new National Geographic book, Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Bill, you were telling us before the break that there was this alleged mischievous teenage ghost in the White House. People wanted it investigated. William Howard Taft said absolutely not to this nonsense. And then what happened?
Well, that's all we know. We don't know. There's no other records that we there certainly wasn't an investigation that was recorded or anything like that. I mean, I think if you've got White House buffs in your audience, and there's many of them out there in the world that love the history of the White House and have read a lot about it, and probably have heard of the ghost of Abigail Adams, for example. You're talking about the laundry. Apparently, you're supposedly able to smell the damp laundry in the air. You've got Dolly Madison, who supposedly was angry about them tearing up a spot of ground out behind the White House where she had a garden, to put the new rose garden in there. And then there was, William Henry Harrison, who supposedly haunts the halls because he was the first president to have died in the White House. So, you know, you have a number of stories that are very well known. And, of course, the Lincoln ghost has got a legend of its own and has gone right into the 20th century. Even the presidents themselves and first ladies have stories of the Lincoln ghost that they've used. And many times they were pranks to either entertain their children or their guests who were staying in the Lincoln bedroom. So there's a lot of lore out there, but this story of the teenage thing sort of always struck me as interesting because it was just sort of one that really is where we're talking about eyewitness observations, so to speak.
Which other presidents besides William Henry Harrison actually died in the White House itself?
Oh, boy, let's see. Actually died in the White House. So that's, I'm just trying to think. You caught me there. I'm just...
Well, we'll have to save that one, and maybe we can Google it later. I was thinking he might be the only one, but
You might
sure
be right. I'm just thinking that most of the assassinated presidents were shot, off-site, and then... even Garfield, who was shot, brought back and laid in his sick bed in the House, and then eventually was taken to New Jersey to the beach, and that's where he died. So, that's a stumper question. I'll have to look into that for you.
All right, good to know. We can check back at some point. So, talk about this. For some reason, we have always been fascinated by the first family's pets, but dogs and cats that are standard these days would have seemed quite boring to many of the earlier inhabitants.
Well, I mean, I think dogs and cats have always been part and parcel of our pet families, whether you're the first family or any American family. I think they're sort of like always high on the list. I think that you just have some, more exotic pets in the 19th century, like Dolly Madison famously had a parrot. Jefferson had a mockingbird. Mrs. McKinley had a songbird of some kind that was very valuable, apparently, as well, that was given to her as a gift. So there were more birds. Of course, the Roosevelt family brought in just about every type of animal imaginable, snakes and different kinds of critters, so to speak, of various and sundry kinds, as well as a number of dogs and cats The Coolidges were also very, very much a pet-loving family, and they had a lot of animals that were both at the house and some exotic ones, like a hippopotamus that was given to the president, but that ended up going out to the National Zoo. they didn't really keep the more exotic ones, and then a number of pets that were from time to time, Americans would send the president a possum or something like that for dinner. The idea being you could have that for dinner. So it kind of it begins to sound a little bit like the Beverly Hillbillies in that regard. But it was obviously pets have always had a place at the White House, they bring a humanity to the presidency that I think all Americans can, associate with. In fact, famously, Herbert Hoover had a photograph of him taken during his campaign with his dog King Tut, a German Shepherd. It was probably one of the few images that sort of captured him in a warm sort of portrait, and it was used throughout, you know, the campaign to try to, you know, help visualize and humanize the presidential candidate.
Little Todd Lincoln had a pet turkey that he did not want used for dinner.
That's right. That's an interesting story too, in terms of, like, you know, we don't really think of this as much today, but Americans used to love to send the president gifts, you know, like turkeys, for dinners, Christmas, and obviously Thanksgiving was just really just a holiday. It was beginning to evolve at that time. So these gifts of turkeys, but also things like prize strawberries, and, you know, at the fair, and, you know, they right up and through into the early 20th century, this bounteous delivery of gifts would occur at the White House, and very often the food would be distributed to the staff and to charities, and not end up on the presidential table. But occasionally there would be a particularly prized gift, like one character named Horace Vose from Rhode Island began delivering prized turkeys to the president's the beginning of the Grant administration. He had an idea behind it, of course, and what the idea was is that he was a purveyor of turkeys in the New York area, and he was a distributor rather than a farmer who grew and raised turkeys. He would then go pick the finest turkeys that were out there and then, of course, sell them in New York, but then he would send the prize turkeys down to the president at Thanksgiving and at Christmas. And these things would be humongous. They'd be 35, 40-pound turkeys that would arrive at the White House. And he would actually slaughter and dress them before he shipped them. They didn't have a chance to get pardoned. So they would end up on the presidential table at dinner. And that went on until his death about 1913. And then a number of others would give the president turkeys after that, and eventually the poultry organizations began to get into the act in the 50s and began giving the presidents turkeys at Christmas, and that's where the beginnings really of the pardoning tradition sort of emanates from that period on from there.
By the way, our Johnny on the Spot producer Stephen Becker has Googled this, I guess, and the two presidents who died in the White House are William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor. Does that sound right to
course,
you, Bill?
Of course, yes, yeah, Zachary Taylor, right. He unfortunately went out on a hot day and then the 4th of July and ate a lot of fruit and drank a lot of milk, apparently, and eventually ended up dying with an intestinal disorder.
Hmm. I did not realize that the front of the White House had changed so much. And in fact, that balcony that we completely associate with photographs of the White House wasn't there until the Truman administration.
The Truman balcony was built during the Truman administration. The portico on the south had been there, mm-hmm. you know, long before that, as well as the north portico. The White House as we know it today was really by 1834 had taken that form. The original house that we saw designed by Hoban that Washington approved had a facade on the north side that was decorated with beautiful carved stone. And that was the wow factor, I guess you'd say, in terms of the house in those days. Eventually, the large the north and south porticos were built and evolved over time. Again, they were both built by Hoban, but it's believed that the design of those porticos was influenced by Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who had worked closely with Thomas Jefferson during his two administrations and had drawn plans that actually showed the types of porticos that were eventually built. But the Truman balcony you're talking about was built in 1948-49, and that was done by Truman to add a sort of a private veranda for the president and his family.
Was slave labor used at all to build the White House?
Of course. Slaves were very much a part of the workforce that built both the Capitol and the White House, the public buildings of the United States. If you think about it for a minute, where is the Washington, D.C.? It's between the states of Maryland and Virginia. It's, in essence, a southern city in many respects. And and one of the big problems that our early founders had in terms of establishing and building the Capitol was the lack of labor. They had hoped that they would be able to draw in European artisans and others who would come over and help build the public buildings of Washington. They were able to do that to some extent. So what you end up with is really a worker village outside the White House, which is made up of a motley crew, really, of African-American enslaved workers who would provide much of the labor, skilled carpenters from Ireland and other parts of Europe, stone cutters from and craftsmen and fine stone carving craftsmen from Scotland who would do the north facade of the house, as well as build the stone walls, and there were other there were other slaves as well who were skilled. Like, for example, James Hoban, the architect, had five skilled carpenters in his that he actually owned that were part of the workforce. So there were a number of African Americans who would be involved from both the unskilled and skilled part of construction, but also there were many Europeans as well. So it was really an admixture. It really was a a reflection of what was going on in terms of who was living in and around Maryland and Virginia at that time.
We have an email here from John in Denton who says, there's a famous photograph of several workmen in a bathtub that supposedly had to be installed after President Taft got stuck. Is that true, or was it part of a renovation that would have had to be that would have been installed no matter who was president?
That's a very interesting question. The famed Taft bathtub in the photograph that he's referring to was not taken in the White House. It was taken another location, and that you can find that photograph in the newspapers of the time. And what it was is that they put a huge bathtub in the, I think it was the USS North Carolina that Taft was taking on a trip, and then it was suggested that the tub should be installed in the White House, after the trip for Taft. And so, we've been trying to track this down and to find out whether or not that tub actually ever was in the White House, and we found nothing really definitive to show that it was. Now, there were stories, of course, of Taft going on vacation and getting stuck in a bathtub and that sort of thing. So you know how this stuff happens. You put two and two together to come up with a nice urban tale, so to speak. that's one of those that we're still doing further research on, trying to find out more about that, to find out if that tub actually was ever in the White House or not. There was a major renovation in 1902 under Theodore Roosevelt. As I said, we've been looking into the records to see if there was anything that would indicate that that tub was installed between 1909 and 1913, but so far we haven't found anything definitive.
How big are the first family's private quarters?
Well, if you think about the house in real estate terms, the White House is 55,000 square feet overall. You're talking about six floors of space. But then you think about, well, what are the actual private areas where the first family can actually live? And that really is just two floors, the second and the third floors of the house. In other words, above the state floor is a traditional long corridor hallway with bedrooms on either side of it that are a total of about 16 family guest rooms in that second and third floor area for the family and their guests. So you don't So you're really talking about maybe a large apartment building as opposed to a huge house to ramble around in, because most of the spaces in the house are for public use. For example, the state floor is a floor that is used for receptions and, of course, people who are touring the house and other kinds of uses that are related to the conduct of state. So that's really not a private area. Then, I mean, of course, the presidents and the families in the past have used those rooms for their private uses of entertaining guests or having a card game or something like that. So or listening or playing music in the Red Room, which was a favorite pastime of many of the 19th century presidents and first ladies. So, so you can use a lot of the building, but in terms of like where can you walk around in your bathrobe and slippers? I think you're pretty much confined to the second and third floors of the house, away from the public eye. So you literally, the president is living above the shop.
The president's office was not always oval.
No, it was not. The president's office was actually in the east side of the second floor of the house, and it was would have been a rectangular form. And there are oval rooms in the old White House proper. There are three of them that through the central core of the house. Below the blue room is the diplomatic reception room. The blue room is on the main state floor, and then there's an oval room that is called the yellow oval room today in the family quarters. Now, that oval room has always been there, but it was used by the family as a library and a sort of a parlor, a retreat, a place where they could go that was private.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We're speaking this hour with William Bouchong, who is historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association and a contributor to the new National Geographic book, Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents. We'll be back to the conversation in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is William Bouchong, historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association and contributor to the new book, Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Bill, I am always fascinated to think about that one harrowing day when administrations turn over and in the span of several hours, and one family has to be moved out and another moved in. Can you tell us how that works?
Yeah, that is probably one of the more fascinating things that we learn when we, hear about the transitions between presidents. It's literally the staff will, in clockwork precision, move one presidential family out in the morning and the other in, and the moving vans will be almost crossing in unison there, and then by the time the president has been sworn in, come down the parade and sat for the parade and done the whole inaugural celebration, and when the family walks back into the house, they can expect to find their favorite food in the refrigerator, and their beds are set up, and it's really pretty astounding when you think about it. Then, of course, there would be time after that in terms of when the presidents and and first ladies would have a chance and the opportunity then to sort of make the house their home by selecting the artworks that they from the collection that they would like in the private quarters. Or the president usually will also, decorate the Oval Office in to his personal preferences as well. And again, very often using artworks from the White House collection, depending on that particular president's interests and who his hero might have been. Sometimes it's many times the bust of Abraham Lincoln makes its way into the Oval Office. But there are other presidents as well who have been honored. Of course, George Washington being a famous example also.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Larry on the line now in Fort Worth. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Well, that was a really great segue to my question, which was just how much leeway does the first family have to customize their quarters? I mean, can they change furniture? Can they remodel? And associated with that, have we ever had to do anything for the private quarters for a family member with special needs? I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks for your call.
Well, yes. I'll get to the special needs quickly because, I think everyone probably famously knows that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who has had four terms as president, was in a wheelchair, and so there were ramps that were placed in the, when the Oval Office was renovated during his administration, there were that was made wheelchair accessible to into that, as well as, of course, there were elevators and ramps as well over stairs in the second floor quarters area. So there have been efforts, in the past for that purpose. The presidents and first families that come into the White House, really since the 1960s, have now in the public spaces, or in other words, the public rooms of the House, those are only changed in conjunction with the advice of what is called the Committee on the Preservation of the White House. And this was established out of a committee that Mrs. Kennedy had formed to advise her on the restoration of the White House in 1961. And then that was made law through the executive order of President Johnson. So we today, as we were talking earlier, that is where the museum influence comes in, is actually the hiring of a professional curator to oversee the house, and its collections, and then that advisory body, which would assist the First Lady and President in any changes in the what would be considered the historic public rooms of the house. Now, the private quarters can be obviously decorated to the taste of the first family, and that often occurs after a family comes into office. They will make the house a home.
We have a question here via email from Dan, who says, I know the White House has been reconstructed a few times and remodeled. How difficult is it to keep the old building structurally sound, or was it built to last several hundred years?
Another interesting question. Of course, the house has been rebuilt several times. Of course, it was rebuilt after the fire, of 1814, and then again they brought back James Hoban to reconstruct what was, in essence, a blackened shell after the British invaded Washington. Rebuilt the house on the interior entirely, and then over the years, you can imagine each family has renovated and changed things over the years. We've added technology, plumbing, gas lighting, electric lighting, and cutting holes and pathways for all those wires and stuff, as you can imagine, eventually weaken the structure. It was renovated in 1902 again by Theodore Roosevelt, but it really was a quick job. It was done in 6 months, and it really was more of a stylistic than a structural change to the house. So by the 1940s, it was the house was for many in many ways, structurally unsound, and I'm sure your audience and you've heard many of the stories of during that period where, for example, Margaret Truman's piano leg went through the floor and that sort of thing, nonetheless, structural engineers had gone into the house. The alarm bells really rang during World War II because it was feared that if a bomb was to be dropped into the house, given its structure, which was timber and frame and wood, it would just go up like a tinderbox. So During the Truman administration, the house was completely gutted. And again, maybe your audience is familiar with some of these photographs of bulldozers actually inside the walls of the White House, which was completely gutted and reconstructed on a steel frame, modernized, air conditioning, electric, the whole HVA systems were completely redone. And then the house was basically rebuilt again into the form we know it today. And the idea behind that by Truman was that it would last for many, many years beyond his presidency because of that. So that's where we are. We're in the exterior of the house. The stone walls are the ones that George Washington oversaw and had built, and the porticos were added, of course, by Monroe and Jackson, and then you've got eventually you have a completely rebuilt interior by Truman. So that's where we are today with the White House.
So Steve wrote in via email to ask about secret passageways, and he's also curious about the null space. In other words, what's in the corners of the Oval Office?
What is in the
behind the Oval Office, I guess.
Let's get to the secret stuff first. I don't really know any of the secret stuff. that it's secret for a reason. Obviously, all I do know there was a. We do know that from public record that a. An air shelter was built under the East Wing during World War II. But what secret passageways and the like are down there, I couldn't tell you. As far as the null spaces, I don't know the answer to that, to be honest with you. I could find out for you if you'd like. And I think I would assume it's just open space. I don't think there's anything secretly hidden there.
It would be sort of disappointing if we find out it's just a closet or something. There's office supplies in there.
Yeah, that's where they keep the cleaning supplies. I don't know, to be honest with you.
So the staff of the White House, what an interesting, and I'm talking about the household staff, what an interesting set of jobs. I didn't realize that over the years, very often generation after generation of the same families have worked in the White House.
That's true. There are many generations of that have worked in the House, both in the 19th and the 20th centuries. It was, a system that sort of evolved where friend, family member, someone who could be trusted was brought into the orbit, I guess you'd say, of the resident staff, and then trained and brought in, because it is a special job. It's not like working in a hotel or something like that. You're working for the President of the United States. There's certain, in terms of your loyalty to the family and the president, in terms of, being not going around blabbing about everything you might overhear, and all those sorts of things that are part of it. But there's also just the special character of it. You're representing the nation as much as you are serving or a family. So, and that's been an interesting distinction that resident staff have always made about working in the White House, is that they are representing the American people when they polish silver or do the various and sundry things, whether it be, fixing the electric or whatever it might be. They are making that house both a place of pride for the American people, but also a place of comfort for the presidents, and of course a wonderful venue for us to have guests from other parts of the world come into that house and to be welcomed and to be a part of that and bringing that side of diplomacy really to bear those kinds of visits and travels.
And they do all have to promise not to sort of spill any secrets even after they leave the employment of the White House.
Well, I don't think that's the case, really. I think, you've probably seen, if you look at the books of that have been published by White House chefs, doctors, you name it, have all written memoirs. That was something that cropped up in the 60s, I think, is a sort of a thing that the Kennedys had wished that they could have done that, but there's no way legally to make somebody not write a memoir of their time in the White House. In fact, there's a rich tradition of memoir writing by staff. But again, there's just this sense of respect that people have who have worked there. When they leave, they just don't tell the the tattletales. They just, you know, they'll tell you a lot about the workings and what impressed them as they in their years of service. But, you know, you just don't, they just don't go there. If you want, you know, they don't tell you the, you know, there's a few funny stories they'll tell you here and there about, you know, about things. But, you know, I just think there's that sense of respect for the first family. And there's a genuine bond that is built between members of the staff at the White House and the presidents. And their families. I mean, you know, they literally have a feeling of strong friendships when they leave the house, and you can find, you know, former presidents' children showing up at workers at their gatherings when they have reunions and things like that, because they really do feel like they're, you know, friendly and part of the family.
So, tell us, Bill, about the White House Historical Association. Are you guys government employees, or is this a private organization?
I'm glad you asked that. The White House Historical Association is a nonprofit private organization. We're an educational organization.
Mm-hmm.
During the government shutdown, of course, everybody thought we were closed, but we certainly weren't. We're not funded by the federal government. The association, in fact, has raised monies over the years through the sale of a Christmas ornament, which we're very well known for, at least in the Washington, D.C. area, that we produce every year that honors the a president. And this year it's Woodrow Wilson's turn. And our website is whitehousehistory.org. So if folks want to find out more about us and who we are, please come and check that out. We've been producing a guidebook since the early 60s that Mrs. Kennedy had had us involved with and helping with, and in fact, our formation really emanates from the beginnings of that guidebook. So we have become a cooperating association with the White House. It's part of a legalistic structure that the Park Service had built as a way to help our national parks. So these associations help raise funds and do other things to help the parks. And our park, of course, is Reservation 1, or the President's Park, which is where the White House is situated. Mm. And the monies that have been generated over the years have been funneled back to the House for the conservation of the public rooms, acquisition of artworks, and the like over the years. And the association, I believe, has topped over $30 million in donations over the years.
Wow. And so it sounds like you have a good cooperative relationship with First Families. They contact you when they're going to, say, install a new painting or put a different desk in the Oval Office, that sort of thing?
Well, actually, the curator's office, of course, would be in, you know, be responsible for the care of the collection itself. The association, you know, works hand in hand with the curator's office as well as the First Family whenever we can. If they want to acquire a work of art, for example, for the collection, we would be the body that would come into that process and help acquire it at auction and then bring it into the collection. The official portraits of the presidents and first ladies, for example, is something the association has been sponsoring.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there because we are out of time. William Bouchong is historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association and a contributor to the new National Geographic book, Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents. Bill, it's been a delight. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.